Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation.
Dr. Margarita Konaev is Deputy Director of Analysis and a Research Fellow at Georgetown Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Interested in military applications of artificial intelligence and Russian military innovation. She's also an adjunct senior fellow with the Center for a New American Security. Previously, she was a non-resident fellow with the Modern War Institute at West Point and a postdoctoral fellow at the Petrel School of Law and Diplomacy. Dr. Konaev's research on international security, armed conflict, non-state actors, and urban warfare in the Middle East, Russia, and Eurasia has been published in a number of journals. She holds a PhD in political science from the University of Notre Dame and an MA in conflict resolution from Georgetown University. Dr. Konaev, many thanks for making the time in your busy schedule to talk to us. We met in Madrid on the occasion of the recent NATO summit, and I had the pleasure of sitting in the audience during one of your interventions when the current conflict in Ukraine figured prominently. In one of your recent articles, you stated that the war in Ukraine has settled into a kind of a grinding fight for territory, you know, inch for inch, yard for yard, so to speak, leading to a kind of a war of attrition where progress tomorrow will be determined by the ability of each side to ensure an influx of troops, ammunition, and heavy equipment to the front lines in the East. If you could just comment briefly on, you know, what are some of the consequences of a slow and sustained war in the heart of Europe for actors such as the European Union, NATO, and neighboring countries, and in general for the security situation in the world at large, especially nowadays when we are so closely integrated, you know, and an event in one part of the world has spillover effects in, you know, many other parts of the world.
Thank you, Augusto, and thank you, first of all, for having me here. It's a real pleasure to have this conversation and to look back at the discussions we had in Madrid on the eve of the publication of NATO strategic concept. I wrote that article a little over a month ago, perhaps even closer to a month and a half, thinking about this new stage in the war in Ukraine, where we are unfortunately reached a moment of essentially a war of attrition. Whereas you described, there is a heavier emphasis on continuous resupply of forces of the Ukrainian resistance and the Ukrainian fight, and increasing dependence on what the Western countries, the NATO allies, the United States, the European countries can do to help and continue to support Ukraine in its fight. And in terms of consequences, I think there are a number that we have to, you know, keep paying attention on. The first one is, unfortunately, that the humanitarian conditions are going to continue to be difficult. We're going to see continued displacement of people from eastern and southern Ukraine, outflows of refugees. At the same time, we're seeing some people come back to Ukraine to, you know, repopulate and resettle the people who've left Kiev, who fled from that area that has become slightly more peaceful and stable now, are coming back. The displacement from the east and the south continues. So that, of course, those refugees flows, those humanitarian disaster conditions are, of course, important for Ukraine, not only itself, but its neighbors and all the countries involved. The second is that Ukraine does not stay in this fight without continued support from the West. So while there's no immediate military solution to this conflict, any hope of keeping Ukraine going forward and perhaps, you know, securing some sort of a favorable political outcome will very much depend on continued support from the West. That means that Ukraine's Western allies, NATO countries, EU countries, have to keep prioritizing Ukrainian security, support for Ukrainian forces, military support, as well as keeping up the sanctions and the pressure on Russia going forward. That, of course, has serious political implications for Western and NATO unity. It has a lot of economic applications, oil security, keeping this commitment through the winter as it gets colder, as there are higher demands on gas and oil in each of the European countries. So the problem with the war of attrition, again, is that goes on and it continues. And with no immediate resolution in sight, a lot of this is about perseverance, and not only Ukrainian perseverance, but the perseverance of Ukraine's friends and allies.
Yes, you know, you mentioned the energy crisis that we're going through. I am today in Madrid, and one can see the strains that the dependence on Russian energy is putting on European economies as we speak. In fact, it may well be that, for instance, the German economy may enter a period of recession because of its dependence on Russian energy. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed for this podcast series Michael Mandelbaum, who is a very distinguished professor at Johns Hopkins University. You may have run into his work as part of your own studies in past years. And at the turn of this century, some 20 years or so ago, he wrote a very insightful piece called Is Major War Obsolete? And at that time, you know, I was persuaded by some of the arguments that he put forward, in particular the idea that in an integrated world, the costs of major conflict had risen substantially for all parties involved, making war utterly impractical and expensive for everybody. And another point that he made, as I remember, is that war was no longer perceived as a kind of a noble patriotic enterprise, which definitely was the case in the two world wars. Something that was a kind of a legitimate expression of one's love and loyalty for country. War today, he argued, was largely perceived as a criminal enterprise, you know, with questionable gains for those taking part in it. And yet here we are. It's 2022, and we find ourselves in the middle of a devastating war in the Ukraine. And many see a future conflict between the United States and China as a distinct possibility, not out of the realm of imagination. My question is, in your view, will war continue to be a feature of the political landscape in coming decades? Who knows, centuries? Will the kind of nationalisms that have led to war in the last 100 years, you know, continue to bring suffering and dislocation to the world as we see today?
This is, of course, a very difficult question, and one that, you know, within my perspectives, within my background as somebody who started her path in activism and in peace building and with a focus of conflict resolution, with the hope to moderate the occurrence and the severity of conflicts, and one way or another ended up in the world of defense, much more so with an understanding, to answer your question, that unfortunately it is most likely that war and conflict will remain an inescapable part of most of the world's lives. Even Europe, which I think to a great degree most of us have assumed as moved beyond major power war and that type of devastation, it seems, cannot escape it. So it's the notion that war doesn't pay because we're in an integrated world, I think, was one of the arguments that people didn't really anticipate the occurrence of World War I, because you did see a great integration in that period of time as well. That didn't stop World War I from happening. Of course, now the world is far more integrated to a great extent. The economic ties between the United States and China are extremely strong, and there's a lot of trade, there's a lot of economic interdependence, but it's clearly not really affecting or constraining some of the heightened security dialogue as we're seeing. I think war remains a feature of international relations, unfortunately. And the best that we can do is prepare as best as we can and be on the cusp of moderating its effect, whether it's through humanitarian means, diplomatic means, reinvestment in rebuilding some of the countries that suffer from it. But I think we will be naive and doing a disservice to ourselves if we predict that there will be no more war. That said, I am hopeful that nuclear deterrence will continue to work as it has since the end of World War II and will prevent major wars between nuclearly armed powers. I think we're seeing it one way or another still working right now. That is, to me, has been a stabilizing force, and hopefully it remains so. But otherwise, I think war is a feature of the modern world going forward, for sure.
Yeah. You know, I think that one of the reasons why this war has been so shocking in Europe is because many, many people, I would say perhaps the majority of European Union citizens, very much saw the European Union as the one region of the world that probably had cured itself from war as an instrument of you know, sort of political power. After all, World War I and World War II took place on European soil, and the European Union experiment was intended, you know, to prevent war from ever taking place again on the continent. And of course, you know, most people would say, yes, there will never be a war between Germany and France, for instance, right? But the Ukraine borders the European Union, and I think that is what has been shocking to most European citizens, governments, and so on, the fact that we are in 2022 witnessing something that we thought would never happen again, certainly not in this part of the world. But in any case, let's move on. One of your research interests is the phenomenon of urban warfare. And I find this very interesting, actually. This is, as you yourself explain in your papers, a type of armed conflict that takes place in urban areas, and that involves often non-state actors and even civilians. And you argue in some of your writings how this form of warfare is actually spreading in the 21st century in many parts of the world, the Middle East, the Central and South America, and in waves of terrorist attacks in various corners of the world, which we have seen over the last, you know, 10, 20 years. You note that by 2050, two-thirds of the global population will live in cities, and this demographic change implies that conflicts will be concentrated in urban settings and therefore involve much more of the urban population. And I think that this is a very, very powerful argument, sort of demography as you know, changing the landscape for warfare. How does this affect the national security strategies of states? In other words, can this type of war, which gives more prominence to non-state actors, displace sovereign states from the monopoly in the provision of security and perhaps lead us towards other models of warfare beyond, you know, the traditionally state-based, you know, system of warfare that we have seen over the last many centuries? And in this connection, do you think that perhaps Ukraine will turn into an example of urban warfare, especially if the conflict continues to be sort of protracted, you know, lasting for many years ahead of us?
Of course. So I just want to, you know, kind of make a few things more clear and differentiate a few of the concepts here. So urban warfare, the way that I've been approaching it and the way that it's usually described, is a all-encompassing, a very broad concept that relates to the conduct of military operations in urban environments, like you insinuated. And urban, it manifests itself differently depending on where it occurs. So for instance, in Latin America, we see it come into play through the involvement of criminal gangs and the involvement of drug trafficking organizations and these criminal organizations that have become so powerful that they can't contest the state, the police, even the military of some of these countries in a confrontation of control over territory, of supplying some of basic provisions to city residents, really running almost a sub-state, a shadow state in some of these cities by controlling the population in order to keep their businesses afloat. That is type of an urban violence that is the parameters of the city define it to an extent. Another type is the terrorism that we've seen in some of the, in European cities, in African cities, the targeting of cities and urban infrastructure by armed non-state groups, terrorist groups of different kinds, where they don't necessarily have the power to contest the state and take territory, but they can still cause a lot of damage by hitting these soft targets like airports, restaurants, cinemas, things of that nature, and really, you know, still cause a lot of havoc. But we can also see urban warfare happen in more conventional conflicts, like the Russian-Ukrainian conflict right now, which is still a war between two independent states. Ukraine is an independent state, and Russia is, of course, an independent state. So the conflict is an interstate one. But it did have and continues to have confrontations in cities. It was in the outskirts of Kiev. We've seen the confrontations in Kherson, some confrontations in Kharkiv, in some of the smaller cities in the east. And that type of urban warfare is also very much falls within the parameters of what urban warfare is, even though it is not a confrontation between a state and armed non-state groups. What is important about the idea of urban warfare is the notion that the city itself, the urban infrastructure, the presence of civilians, the interconnectedness between different types of urban services, electricity, sewage, health provisions, how all of these things are intertwined and interlinked, very much shapes the way that violence unfolds, the way that military operations unfold, in a way that is different from any type of conflict that is fought in a different type of terrain, perhaps in the periphery or in the outskirts of countries, in rural areas, in less populated areas. This, in particular, really the element of civilian presence, I think, is one that we really have to concentrate on when we're thinking about the future of urban warfare. Because we are used to still think about war in terms of conventional means where an army confronts another army. It's tanks on tanks, missiles on missiles, soldiers on soldiers. But we're definitely seeing in Ukraine right now, and even before that in the Middle East and Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan, the presence of civilians very much intertwined, intermingled, where war is occurring. And in cities, when war comes to cities, the majority of casualties are civilian. So it's the toughest type of fight on civilians. So when we're thinking about the future of warfare, we're thinking about, you know, how do we prepare, how do we, you know, manage some of these conflicts, we have to acknowledge that civilians will be present on these urban battlefields. And we have to think about whether our, you know, humanitarian laws, our responses, even our entire concepts of how we approach, you know, these phenomena, are they up to date? Because we are no longer really dealing with state versus non-state groups, state versus state, army versus army. There's so much more gray here now. And so much of that gray is because of the focus on cities.
Yes, very fascinating, Margarita. This idea that the city then becomes the battlefield and the casualties are the soldiers as well as the citizens, you know, civil society, children, old people, women, and the rest. It's a very dark, dark turn, you know, in terms of the definition of warfare. And it's interesting to see how victory now in this context is defined essentially as turning a city into rubble, having much of the population escape and migrate and move to other parts of the country, and then the army walks in and claims victory, you know, over essentially, you know, what is left, which very often is very little. Let me move on. Some scholars in the West, and I have heard this argument also mentioned in other parts of the world, you know, have argued that the real threat to Russia, of course, is not military, certainly in the context of the current conflict with Ukraine. An independent Ukraine, firmly anchored in European values, democracy, respect for human rights and the rule of law, a free and independent press, a judicial system that is free from interference from you know, the executive, and eventually Ukraine joining other countries in Central and Eastern Europe in the European Union, this is the real threat. This is a political threat to Russia's current system of governance. It shows Russian voters that there is a viable alternative to authoritarianism, that no one in the West is out to destroy them in the same way that no one is out to destroy India or Brazil or some other sovereign nation. Do you think that there is some validity to this view, or do you think that perhaps it's a somewhat simplified way to take a look at a very complex problem?
I think it's a complex problem. I never really, you know, I find it difficult to believe there is the most important reason or a single reason for something. In complicated international relations, let alone warfare questions, it's always a combination of factors. There's no argument that a functional Western democracy with a shared history based on, you know, the Soviet Union, right on Russia's border, a flourishing society that went the Western route, is not something that Putin would be enamored with, because it does. It shows an alternative path, a freer society, one that is, you know, lives at peace with the West and is part of the Western institutions and is intertwined with that part of the world. Of course, it is a threat. It's a perception threat to the way that Putin has established the Russian society. But I don't think that that is something that is the only or really even the main reason for the initiation of this war, which I think is a far more complicated set of factors. The idea is that Russia, of course, has seen, from at least my reading of the way that Putin interprets the world around him, is that he doesn't truly believe in genuine, from the bottom up, indigenous democracy in societies around him, let it be Georgia or Ukraine or Poland or countries like that. He imagines that there is interference from the West that promotes these ideas, these color revolutions, that seeks to undermine Russia's sphere of influence, Russia's way of life, Russia's connections to its broader world, broader diaspora, countries that it seems akin to it or hopes to keep down next to it. So even if Ukraine was to develop into a functioning democracy and one that could have been a beacon of post-Soviet democratic revival, it's not that Putin would have seen it as such. He would still consider it as an example of Western interference and a regime that has been stood up and brought up by NATO as a way to counter and threaten Russian interests. I'm not saying that's true, of course. That's absolutely not true. But that would be the interpretation from there. So it would continue to be a threat to him one way or another.
Yeah. I think what I find puzzling about sort of the Russian position is that I see virtually no strategic benefits for them as a consequence of having invaded the Ukraine, you know? All that you see are costs, and I'm specifically thinking of essentially the destruction of the Russian economy, which is taking place today, which is going to have, you know, fairly important implications for prosperity, for income per capita, you know, for the ability of the economy to continue to integrate itself with the rest of the global economy. In fact, it's cutting itself off from the rest of the economy, and this will have, you know, I think, fairly dire implications for the population and for the country's position in the global economy. But in any case, let's move on, and I want to ask you about the research that you have done in the area of military applications of artificial intelligence, which is another of the areas in which you have developed some expertise. How is technology changing the nature of war? And are you concerned about the malignant uses of technology in coming years or decades that might have unforeseen consequences? Would you agree with those who argue that COVID showed that we need to rethink the concept of national security, which at the moment is unduly concerned with military aspects of security, and that perhaps we need to move gradually in the direction of redefining national security in a broader framework that puts human security and welfare at its center? I realize, as I have posed the question, that maybe there are two questions there, but let me give you the microphone, so to speak.
I'll give it a go. I'll start with the second question first, in terms of redefining national security. I think we fundamentally have to rethink national security because the world is forcing us, because the state of going back to the conversation we just had about, you know, the prospect of seeing more conflicts that affect cities and the emphasis there on the human costs that come from that. Our idea of national security is still very military focused, but we are not fundamentally prepared to deal with this in the how humanitarian costs of conflicts are intertwined, how the economic costs of conflicts are intertwined, all of these other tools that one way or another, the technological dimensions, how they all affect national security, we have to be thinking about them. And, you know, back in the 90s and the early 2000s before 9/11, there was a resurgent movement to look into human security, to think more from, like you said, from the human in the center. That kind of dissipated during the global war on terror and then really was put to bed with this resurgence of the strategic competition. Again, I may be biased coming from the American perspective and doing most of my work in the United States with the U.S. national security perspective. I know that that European countries tend to think much more broadly about security, but in the United States, I think there's absolutely an important time right now to rethink national security. And a lot of it also has to do with some internal problems that the United States is having. Some of the domestic disturbances, the rise of domestic terrorism, ultra-nationalist right-wing actors here, the disturbances that come from there, our understanding currently of national security is definitely too narrow to deal with some of these, rising threats. To speak to the question of technology and how technology may redefine or reshape the future of war, it's funny because it really is a question that we are in the midst of trying to envision, but also at the same time are already seeing. So drones are perhaps our most noticeable and notable example. One important thing to remember about drones is that they have become effectively ubiquitous, especially the drones that are used for intelligence collection and surveillance. With some minimal modifications to them, they can also be used for strikes. They are cheap, they are easily manufactured, and they're easily purchased and bought. And they're accessible to non-state actors, to criminal actors, to just private actors, but they're also accessible to, countries that have previously have not had major industrial military capacities, like Turkey or Iran or actors like that, that have not been at the cusp of innovation, have become very important in the drone game, for instance. And we're seeing the type of damage that these drones can cause for conventional major equipment, major military equipment. So we got to be thinking, how do we defend against these threats? How we redefine our counter drone strategies? How do we train our people? What do we do on the electronic warfare dimension? How do we implement air defenses? Before the war started, I had an interview where someone asked me if I think the Turkish drones that Ukraine is buying are going to have any sort of an effect on the war. And I said no, because I assume that Russians, as an established, large, expensive military, is going to implement really effective air defenses against drones. But they didn't. They didn't prepare for that threat at all. They're still struggling with it. And clearly, Ukraine is making very effective use of these tools. So even the countries you think will be prepared, who have seen by now what these types of technologies can do, were not. And another interesting thing about, we talk about drones a lot right now, and we kind of assume that they're just flying around there on their own, that they're automatic or autonomous. But they're not. The absolute majority of drones are remotely operated by people who are maybe not even that far in the field, not that far away from them. And in the more sophisticated versions of them are indeed very far away from them. But what happens when developments in AI and autonomy enable these drones to execute some of these missions on their own, essentially, whether they're pre-programmed or to a point where they can make decisions as they go, as they learn from the environment, as they integrate and analyze the data that they inhale as they're up there? How do we talk about human control over operations there? How do we think about responsibility and accountability? We know that politics is, excuse me, that warfare is the continuation of politics by other means. And politics is a very human endeavor. When we have machines continuing the politics by other means, what does that mean about us as humans? What does this mean about our politics, our role in future warfare? Where is this balance? Where are the lines? This is all the conversations that we are having right now in the community about autonomy and the role of AI in the future of war. It's not just the hardware and software conversations. These are philosophical and very important, legal, moral questions about the role of humanity and humans in war and our decisions.
Your comments, which I find very, very interesting, sort of raise another interesting question, which I am not going to ask you to comment on because I have another question coming up. But it sort of raises the question of whether our current military infrastructure and hardware is not, in fact, somewhat out of date, that it reflects in many ways the last war that we fought, you know, the last big war. In the case of the United States in particular, I'm thinking World War II, you know, and that technological change is so fast, right, that we may need to catch up and adapt to these changing circumstances, and that a lot of the stuff that we have today may actually not be very useful in the future, you know, which raises itself the question of the enormous economic waste that sometimes goes along, you know, with the buildup of military machinery and so on. Let's go back a little bit to this issue of artificial intelligence. You make the point that it is drastically changing the security landscape and the reality of war, and your earlier comments, I think, made that very clear. Now, this obviously has implications for international law and international organizations. I'm thinking of the United Nations in particular, which presumably, and this is my question, do you think that they must take steps towards regulating military applications of artificial intelligence, such as was the case in the last century with the non-proliferation and nuclear arms control?
Of course, I think that's a really important question, and I think it's one that is very difficult to navigate because artificial intelligence is fundamentally different from previous developments in weapons and military equipment, predominantly because artificial intelligence is not a weapon. It is a set of technologies that are dual-use technologies. That means that a lot of their applications are, in fact, found in the commercial space, in the civilian space, in things like our iPhones, in Netflix, in our computers, in the recommendation systems that tell us what to order next, in the way that in banking and finance and medicine. It's all across the board in autonomous cars that are coming. So there is a massive set of commercial and business applications that have nothing to do with the military realm. So it's not the same as we're thinking about regulating, let's say, landmines, where there's a very clear use for landmines, which are a weapon. Whether they're anti-tank landmines or anti-personnel landmines, they have essentially one job, which is to kill and destroy. Artificial intelligence is a set of technologies. It's an enabler. It's very different from a weapon. So even when we get to a point where artificial intelligence is integrated into weapon systems, it works very differently. In thinking through how to regulate something like that, we don't really have pre-existing clear examples of how to approach it. And we don't have the set of pre-existing regulations that we can draw on in the same way that we would be able to if this was, in fact, a clear-cut weapon. So if you have, for instance, artificial intelligence integrated in, let's say, a drone, and it's used as part of the system that is designed to navigate, to decide where the drone is going, is that illegal? Should we regulate that? What if it's used there to process information and to inform decision-making about what sort of direction the drone should take? If it's there and it's taking pictures, it's helping to identify and track a particular target, is that where we begin to regulate it? Or is it when it's integrated as part of a system that can, in fact, automatically or even autonomously shoot out a rocket? Is that a lethal autonomous weapon that we pre-design it in a way that we explicitly told it to target this particular specific target? Does that mean that it's autonomous? At what point does human control end? So there's a whole slew of legal, moral questions that are very, very difficult to navigate because they're integrated with technological details and dimensions that are very, very complex. And there's not necessarily an agreement on within the technological community, let alone the political community. And I am not 100% sure that international law or international humanitarian law is currently congruent with dealing with those technological aspects or even have a good read of. What international humanitarian law is extremely good at is in regulating how to fight wars. And technology, in the end of the day, whether it's AI or any sort of other, you know, tools, is still a way, is still subject to the decisions that people make about how wars would be fought. And there are very clear laws that say this is a legitimate way to use force, and this is a not legitimate way to use force. So if you employ AI to target a military target, that is still within the legitimate use of force. But if you employ it to target a hospital, international humanitarian law is already very clear on that. That is an illegitimate use because that is a civilian target, predominantly civilian target. So I think we already have the laws that regulate how wars are fought and what are legitimate behaviors. Whether we need to evolve them to accommodate developments and evolutions in technology is an ongoing debate. But I think we have to be aware that we're right now also dealing with problems that we're not seeing an abidance by international humanitarian law, even without the presence of advanced technologies. So perhaps we should focus on making those laws stronger and the consequences for breaking them more coherent and immediate before we even begin to, you know, continue the conversation about how to regulate technology.
All right. Thank you, Margarita. Very interesting viewpoint. Let me pose a last question in this podcast, which has been very, very substantial in content and really fascinating in many of your perspectives. Do you have some words of hope to some of the followers of the Global Governance Forum and social media platforms? 35% of the more than 800,000 followers are under the age of 30. What can you say to them at a time when, and I think this has been clear from the content of this conversation, the world confronts multiple crises on various fronts, and the future at times may seem bleak, you know, to many of these young people? You are working today at Georgetown University. You come into contact every day with young people. What can you tell them?
I will tell them that there is, the bleakness is not preordained. And it's actually the times that are the hardest and the most seemingly devastating that can give birth to the most inspiring of movements. And I will tell them that right now is the opposite of the time to give up and grow inured to the difficulties that we're seeing. And in fact, this time should serve as an inspiration for the possibilities that we have ahead of us. I think the generation of the young people today is the most interconnected, in many ways the most progressive, the most aware of the difficulties and interconnected challenges that we face, whether it's climate change, inequality, economic insecurity, the erosion of civil rights and privacy, the rise of authoritarian government. I think this is a generation that effectively sees everything around them, and they are impassioned to work towards a more stable and globally integrated and peaceful future. And they have numerous opportunities and venues to affect change, whether it's through social activism, whether it's through their careers, whether it's on a subnational level, at a city level, at a state level, at a municipal level. There's so many, at a non-governmental organizations, there's so many venues to practice living the reality you want to see implemented. Like I said, I come from activism. I dedicated my youth one way or another to working towards the Israeli and Palestinian peace and peace building and coexistence. I mean, I can't absolutely say that I've fixed or solved that conflict. Of course, it remains a serious challenge, but those were some of the most meaningful times of my life. And I think there's just so much you can do to make your own world better and the bigger world better, that this is the absolutely wrong time to lose faith. If anything, this is really the time to galvanize, because there's just so many opportunities to make things better. So get busy and stay strong. It's not easy for sure, but without you, it only gets worse.
Listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.